Have you ever heard someone say you need to twitch your fly or you need to twitch it more? Have you maybe heard about jigging or using jigs and fly fishing and why and how this is such an effective method? Today we bring both of these together as we jump back into Alaska and fishing northern Bristol Bay. Jeremy Fries is here to share the twitch and jig method and why pink is the only color you need in Alaska. This is the Wet Fly Swing Podcast, where I show you the best places to travel to for fly fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that big trip, and how to give back to the fish species we all love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing Podcast. I've been fly fishing since I was a little kid. I grew up around a fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in the country. I've also interviewed more of the greatest fly anglers than just about anyone in the world. Today, Jeremy Fries is here to walk us through Togiak River fishing and everything there is up in northern Bristol Bay. We're going to dig deep into all the salmon species up there, how to fish for them, why he has an unlikely story of making the Alaska trip an annual thing for him, and why he loves pike fishing. That's the big bonus today. You're also going to hear how to plan your trip and the exact tips you need for success in Alaska this year. Here we go, Jeremy Fries, digging back into Togiak Lodge and River. Let's do it. How you doing, Jeremy?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for putting this together. We are going to dig back into Alaska today, a favorite spot, I think, for a lot of people. It's a favorite spot for people that are, it's on their bucket list, they've never been there, but people that have been there, I feel like, want to keep going back. And you're one of those people that have been back to Togiak a few times. So we're going to talk about some species and dig in deeper today on that. But before we get into that, why don't you take us back to fly fishing? How did you get into fly fishing? What's your first memory?
Yeah, so for me, fly fishing, I've come into fly fishing later in life. You know, I come from an outdoors family, and my youngest memories are fishing with the family, and caught my first steelhead on a spoon at 12 years old. And I really liked fishing, but it wasn't quite as much of a passion for me as it was something for my family. So I went into music and teaching. And then about 7 or 8 years ago, my wife had fly fished. Mm. So about 7 or 8 years ago, we bought fly rods and we started fly fishing a little bit and kind of got really hooked on it, like it has a tendency to do. And 7 or 8 years later, and now, you know, I've spent 5 summers in Alaska at my cousin's lodge, and we have our brand new drift boat that should be here in about 2 weeks.
Oh, nice.
I have a 10-foot raft that I float our local river in, and I'm going to start guiding for Red's Fly Shop this summer.
Oh, you are? River, and, oh, you're working with Red's?
Yeah. So that's kind of been, you know, the last 7 or 8 years. When I get into something, I'm a little bit addictive to anything. So fly fishing's been that thing over the last 7 or 8 years.
Love it. Yeah, Red's is awesome. We'll put a link to the show note to the episode we had with them a while back. That was a good one. He's knowledgeable. Who's the guy you see up on social quite a bit up there with Red's?
Joe.
Yeah, Joe. Yeah, he seems like he's super knowledgeable. Does he just kind of know everything about how to do it up there?
He's knowledgeable, but he's not intimidating.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's easy to talk to Joe, and he's personable, and he doesn't make you feel inferior at all. He's part of the reason that I've jumped in with them, and I'm excited to be working with them.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's great. So you got the Red's connection. Now tell me what boat. I'm not even going to guess because there's so many great boats out there. So what do you got coming?
Well, we live in Washington, and you know there's so many great options here in the Northwest for drift boats that I decided to go to Michigan and have Stealthcraft build me a boat and ship it out from Michigan.
Oh, wow. So you're doing the opposite. So you got the Stealthcraft.
Got the Stealthcraft covering. Yeah,
that's really cool. Yeah, we had the founder of Stealthcraft on recently too, who it's a cool story because he has a really unique boat.
Is that Mike?
Yeah, it was Mike.
Yeah, and Mike's great to work with. Like, he's helped me out so much, and my wife and I are real excited about getting the boat here.
God, so now what, just tell us a little bit on that. What's the boat you guys got? Because don't they customize it, or they're pretty unique on their boats?
Oh yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of why, because I was looking at used boats for a while, and finally I was like, man, I'm 50 years old. This is kind of my retirement dream, is to have this boat. I'm just going to do it. So we completely customized. We got a 15-foot bighorn skiff and custom colors. Green's my colors. It's black and green. Put the full rod storage in it. It's got a top on it.
Yep.
Like, it's just decked
out.
Does it have the automatic
anchor?
I did not get that. I'm kind of adamant that I'm going to earn it a little bit. That
yeah.
Just seemed a little, that's not a, That's if you want, to get that, get a sled or something. I want a drift boat. So I kept a little more pure. Probably not going to put a combustion engine on. I might get a petroleum motor for it to go into some of the lakes and everything. But yeah, super cool.
This is great.
Can't wait to get it.
Yeah, this is going to be awesome. Nice. So yeah, so I mean, boats, obviously, I love boats. I love talking drift boats and everything. Maybe we'll hold that for later on today. But I want to talk Togiak because I think that Alaska, like I said, is a really popular place for a lot of people and they want to get up there. So I want to paint the picture of, you know, a little more on Togiak and what it is up there, but also the species, like, you know, what you're fishing for. And I know they kind of have a lot of the normal things you would expect, but what was your last, I mean, talk about your first trip versus say your last trip up there. Do you try to like hit a new species every time? Or are you trying to like hook everything, every trip you go?
Yeah. So my first trip up there, I was still pretty, I've been fly fishing for about a year. So I was pretty novice. And after being up there for 5 days, I felt, you know, I'd caught quite a few fish. I had figured out the bead fishing, which, you know, if you're talking fly fishing, Alaska fly fishing is way different. I live in Washington. I live a half hour from the Yakima River. And, you know, I fish a lot of dry flies, hopper dropper, putting a stone fly under an indicator, the traditional, you know, Western river fishing. Well, when you go to Alaska, it's very different. So when I got up the first time, just casting, you know, you're not double hauling a whole lot when you're fishing a bead. It's a different experience. And so learning that whole process my first year, you know, as a newbie was kind of a lot of work. And then over the years, I've really adapted. So every year that I go back, I spend the whole 8 or 9 months I'm at home thinking about the next summer, going up to Alaska and new ways to approach the fish and things that we could maybe do with the fly rod that I hadn't done yet. One of the big transitions for me was they fish a lot of twitching jigs on a spinner rod up there. Huh. And they're really, really successful. My uncle in particular, he ties his own twitching jigs. He's really into it.
Uh-huh.
And I was watching him and I'm watching how he's using a twitching jig. And I was like, I know I can figure out how to do that on a fly rod. So I spent a lot of time kind of taking a big, because you can't really throw a twitching jig. They're, you know, it's a pretty heavy fly. And so I pared that down over the years. I got some tungsten beads. I wrapped it in lead.
Hmm.
But I kind of imitated and made a jig that's real similar to a twitching jig that I can put on a fly rod.
Okay.
And once I did that, it opened up a whole lot of, you know, the chums. Oh my gosh.
Oh really?
Oh, you could catch chums until your arm falls off.
How do you fish the twitching jig? How would that look like? Or how do you set it up?
So there's two different ways. I like to use my 8-weight and I fish it with a floating line and a sinking line, just depending on the environment where we're at. But in order to get a twitching jig, because to get a twitching jig to operate the right way, you got to twitch it up because it's like that whole jigging, swimming motion is what attracts the fish.
Yep.
Well, a lot of times that's really hard to get it to do with a fly line. You know, it sits on top of the water. It's heavier. It's more cumbersome. So I just played around with how much do you have to twitch that fly line to get it to act that same way. And if I'm in shallower water, I'll use a floating line because I think they'd like it better when they see that thing jump up and then fall back down. Usually I'll take it on the fall. So I would use a floating line in those situations, but sometimes you got to get it deeper. Like you just can't get it deep enough with a floating line. So then I'd have to switch to a sink tip to get the fly down more. It's just harder to get that motion when you get it down deeper.
Yeah.
But I've watched sockeye in the right situation in a big pool. You know, I'll have my twitching jig off the back of the boat and we can see them down there.
Yeah.
And you can twitch it and get it just a jig the right way. And you'll watch the sockeye come up and slam the jig.
Hmm.
So that's been a fun new experience, is kind of figured out how to take what they're doing with gear and then put that into the fly situation and figured out the twitch and jig. And then I brought that home to my home rivers, fishing streamers on my home river, and I do it the same way. And it's really effective here.
No kidding.
Real
so,
effective.
So here. The twitch and jig, and is the leader set up just your short leader, or what's that look like?
If you're running a floating line, I like to run a longer leader so it can get down deeper. And then if you're running the sink tip, I'll run a 9, maybe 10 foot leader behind a floating line. But on a sink tip, I'm going to run a 4 or 5 foot leader to keep the fly down. If you run too long of a leader on a sink tip, it wants to float up and it's not going to pull it down as deep as you need it.
Sure. Gotcha. And what's a typical sink line? What are the sinking lines you bring up to Alaska?
I usually use anything that's the middle ground of the sink tips.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't like to get real aggressive with it. And if you need it to go deeper, throw a couple of split shot on there. You know, and that's another. And I don't use split shot here at home hardly at all. But when I'm up there, split shot's in my bag. you're going to be using quite a bit of split shot between the beads, getting the beads down, and then putting those on the streamers to get them down. You just use more split shot, which is dangerous because when you're casting, you know, you got that split shot on there, and you want one ting of that split shot on your fly rod, you're probably going to break your tip. So you got to be real careful with your casting up there.
And is the you mentioned the bead setup? Is that bead setup for any certain species, or when do you use that?
Yeah, I actually, over my time going up there, I've developed my own bead leader. So I like to use any kind of a tapered leader, usually like a 3X. And I'll take a 9-foot 3X tapered leader, and then I cut it to about 5 or 6 feet. And then I tie a loop knot in it, and I put a tippet ring in that loop knot. Oh, and I got all of this from Joe's. If you look up Joe from Red's,
yep.
He has a couple of tutorials of making these leaders for here at home, fishing fly or anything, you know. So then off of that tippet ring, you run, you know, 2 or 3 feet of fluorocarbon. And then I put my bead on the bottom of that as if I was going to put a stonefly on it. And that said, what's really nice about that is that if you're fishing a bead, you got to be down near the bottom. And you're going to snag some things. But if you do with that setup, you're going to break off your bead. You're not going to lose your whole setup. And that's kind of key. I run my indicator above the loop knot with the tippet ring. So if it's going to break off, it's going to break off below there. You never lose your indicators. It's just a real good way to do that. And then, you know, on that 3-foot piece of fluorocarbon down to my bead, I can run 1 split shot, 2 split shot, whatever I need in depth to get down to where I need to be. Mm. A lot of people, when they go up there, they just want to take a piece of, you know, 10-pound maximum. They run it off your line,
yep,
and they put the bead at the bottom. But you don't have that taper. You really need that taper to be able to still cast and get the bead to turn over, you know, and extend. You really want the bead landing, you know, underneath of where your indicator is going to hit. And you have a lot more control if you have that 5 feet of tapered line getting it where you need to be versus just a, you know, an 8 or 9 foot long piece of 10 foot maxima. You have no control with that. There's no taper in it.
No, so. Gotcha. So, okay. And so you have the 5 foot of your leader, your tapered leader that's cut down, and then your lead. What is your fluoro length of the tippet?
Probably, you know, at the most 3 or 4 feet.
Yeah.
Because you can slide your indicator further up that tapered leader if you want to go deeper. But usually when I'm fishing a bead, you're looking for slow water that's 4 feet deep.
Okay.
That's where you're going to find the fish.
4 feet deep. And which fish are you looking for?
So if I'm using my bead, so here's, I was talking about the chums.
Yeah.
The pinks are also pink. There are so many pinks.
Oh, there are.
Oh my gosh. On a pink year, I went up there 1 year for silvers right at the very beginning. It was the peak of the pinks. And from the lodge on the dock, I caught 100 pinks in about an hour and a half.
And what are those pinks? Are these pinks looking pretty chrome coloration?
Oh, yeah. The lodge is only, we're 6 miles up from the salt.
Right. So you're getting fresh.
They haven't been in the system very, oh yeah. And so the pinks, if you're fishing a streamer, the pinks are nonstop and the chums are nonstop. So I'll go back and forth the technique I'm using depending on what fish I want to catch. If I want to catch pinks and I want to catch chums, I'm going to fish a pink streamer.
Okay.
And there's a saying this is good information,
yeah,
too. In, sure. On the Togiak, there's a saying that, you know, any color works for your flies as long as it's pink.
Right.
And we've done some experiments there at the lodge. You know, we'll take a pink bead versus an orange bead. You throw the orange bead in the water and the fish kind of react to it. But then you take pink and the smolts are just like this ball around that pink. They want the pink.
This is so good. We just had Jim Teeny on, which I know the guy is Jordan. Justin know him. He's kind of a famous old angler who's fished the Togiak. And he said the same exact thing. He's like, he's done that before. And for kings, he's like, man, pink and orange just doesn't do it. Right. And so nope. you're right on.
Yeah. And so all of my flies that I tie, they're all pink.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, all of my materials for tying, I have my Alaska tie material. It's all pink.
It's all pink.
And then all my other stuff is black and olive and, you know, for here at home.
Yeah. What are a few of those streamers? What would be a streamer you'd use? Is there a name or is it just throwing on some pink stuff on a fly?
Yeah. These are the ones I've created to imitate a twitching jig. So anything you can find that has a tungsten bead on it, about a size 4, size 6 hook, some pink marabou with some flash in it, you can probably make it work.
Yep. That's it. Yeah. Nothing too. I mean, you're just imitating pink flesh or whatever it is. They're hitting flash or do you put a little flash in it?
Well, yeah, I like to have, they need some sparkle just to grab their attention. And I think it's actually, because most of those fish, being 6 miles from the salt, even those, the rainbows, they're going out in the salt.
Oh, they are.
Like, they don't call them steelhead, but I mean, the dollies, for instance, is it a dolly? Is it a bull trout? Is it an Arctic shark? You know, that whole discussion.
Right.
Well, we have up there, there's resident dollies, and they come in and they have pink on them. They're more colored up. But then every so often you'll hook a dolly and you'll be like, is this a pink? You know, as you're fighting, you see it flashing. It's so bright. You're like, well, it's a sea run dolly.
Yeah.
And
wow.
They're out there eating shrimp and all kinds of, you know, there's a lot of.
Are they bigger? Are those sea run dollies bigger?
No, usually they're not bigger, but they fight a lot harder. They have more spunk to them. But
God, this is awesome.
The biggest dollies are the resident dollies that are, you know, right in the system. So I think the pink, I think that pink is more from out in the salt. I don't think it's a, they're seeing that as a flesh fly. I think they're seeing it as some kind of a shrimp.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. You're right, because you're so low. Yeah, it's just the shrimp. It's the, yep, gotcha.
And I think that's why that jigging action of a twitching jig is so important, because it looks like a shrimp swimming in the water. I don't think they've seen any for a while. I think they're just reacting to what they knew from before.
And so describe that again. So it sounds like this twitch and jig works for all the species, but describe, so let's just say you're shallower water, you got the dry line, you got the twitch. How do you twitch it and jig it to make it catch a fish?
So you want the line to, I'm only moving the line maybe 2 inches, but it's a quick jab. And whenever you jab it like that, it's causing the fly under the water to jump.
And you mean pull up by jab, like pull up?
Yeah, so I'm stripping the line towards me in little, like, 4-inch twitches. Twitch.
Oh, gotcha.
Twitch.
Yeah.
Twitch. Twitch. And every time I twitch it, it makes that fly jump. And then you got to pause and let it kind of fall back down.
Gotcha.
And it gives it that whole jigging effect in the water. That when you use it, and I have fish spin my spinning rod up there quite a bit, too, with the twitch and jig. And when you're using a spinning rod, you can really get it to jump like that. So all you're doing is imitating that same thing with your fly rod.
Yep. That's great. Okay, perfect. And so it sounds like all the fish you're catching up there, and I'm sure there's a little bit of overlap, but these fish are mostly all the species. They're bright. They're pretty much just coming in fresh out of the ocean.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. Do you have to time it on timing of, does it help at all on tides and stuff like that? Or is it pretty much fishing's good, you know, all day, all times?
At the lodge, the tide does really affect the fish, and you can tell.
Yeah.
There's just certain times. And a lot of it is when the tide's coming in, the water gets more murky.
Yep.
There's more color to the water. And I think that really affects the fish a lot more. And when the tide's going out and water gets more clear, they're more reactive.
Yep.
But, you know, once you get up the river another 2 miles from the lodge, the tides really don't affect the water anymore.
Oh, gotcha.
And it's less important. Other than, you know, the tides do affect when the salmon are coming in and all the other species are reacting to the salmon, the food source.
Yeah, that's right.
There's not a whole, you know, down here in Washington, my local river, there's a whole lot more food source there than there is up in Alaska. So those trout, man, they're following those salmon because they need the eggs. That's where they're going to get their food source.
Yeah.
So then the locals can't net up there. And so a lot of times if the nets are out, there's less sockeye coming up in. That affects everything. That'll affect the trout. And then they'll have to take the nets out. Then a big push of the salmon come up. And as soon as that happens, you'll see a lot more of the rainbows dollies follow.
Oh, right. That's it. Yeah. So they're following up, and then the dollies, rainbows and everything. This is cool. Well, my question was going to be for you on timing. I'm planning to head up there this summer, and I was kind of looking at getting July just because I haven't really done the Chinook thing fully. And do you feel what do you think about that?
You're coming up to the Togiak?
Yeah. Yep. I'm planning on coming up.
I would go as late as you can in the king season.
Like when would it be late? What's late?
Are you going to fly fish or are you going to gear fish?
No, yeah, I'll fly.
Then you want to go up there as late in that king season as you can.
Okay.
The trout fishing is actually better. Now, I mean, if you're wanting to hook a king on a fly rod, which is a cool experience, you'd need to go up a little earlier. But if you're up there for the flight, I mean, when I go up there, I'm going up there to target the rainbows and the dollies. That's my, I mean, catching the salmon's fun. But the trout is where my heart's at.
Yeah.
And the best trout fishing is the very end of the king season. So you're talking end of July.
Oh, end of July would be the best trout fishing?
End of July. And they actually just, so the made it illegal to use bait on the Togiak River last summer.
Yep.
And they just got a little bit of an adjustment to that for this year, to where after July 15th, you can use some bait if you're not targeting kings. You can't use any bait at all if you're targeting kings. And like the sockeye, the way we get that to happen is you find a deep pool where the sockeye are kind of pooling up for a second. They're not, because most of the time sockeye are just running to the lake. They're just wanting to get up to the lake. But every so often, especially if the water's higher and some of the slack water, they'll pool up for a second. They stop. And when they do that, they actually start eating again.
Oh, wow.
So I would go after July 15th. If you're wanting to get in some real good sockeye fishing on a fly rod, you're going to want to go after the 15th of July.
Okay. And what if it was just for just Chinook? What if Chinook is your focus only?
If you're wanting to go up for Chinook, you're going to want to be up there at the beginning of July. You're wanting to get Chinook, especially if you're like, because they have a new movement happening up there, and it's the two-headed spey fishing. And they got quite a few people really getting into coming up there and targeting kings on a spey rod. And that season's going to be the beginning of July.
Yeah, so that's what we're hitting. So I think, yeah, we got a huge, I mean, we have a audience of all around the country and all different types of techniques, but the spey is definitely, I think, for me and for a lot of people, catching a king on, you know, just the whole thing would be cool with the spey. Yep.
And you can still, I mean, there's times that you can still be, you know, doing that in the main channel and targeting the kings on the spey rod. But then you can, one of the afternoons, you can run up the side trib and just fit in, focus on trout with the single handed.
That's exactly what I think Jordan was and Justin were on it because I described what I was thinking that people would like to do. And, you know, that's it. I mean, I definitely would, I could see catching a king and then going up and, well, that was amazing. Now let's go see if we can find some. Is mousing going to happen in July?
The problem is that the trib is too high.
Oh, right. It's too high.
Mousing gets a lot better when the water comes down. When it's so low that you can hardly get the jet boat up that river, the side trib, that's when it fishes the best up at the trib.
Yeah, but you can still get them on beads or other techniques.
Or streamers.
Oh, fishing nice.
Streamers you works can. Real well. Early on, the earliest I ever got up the side trib was middle of June. I was up there for the setup period before the clients start coming up. And we were able to go up and target it was right during the spawn. And the rainbows were going crazy. And I was targeting them with, there was no mousing, but on a streamer, I did real well.
Yeah.
And then I got a grayling up. The side trip I keep talking about is called the Geeshik River.
Oh, yeah. The Geeshik. Yeah.
We called Geeshik.
Okay.
Yeah. And early, I've caught a couple of grayling up in there, which is a unicorn on that river. There's not a ton of grayling like some of the other rivers up there, but they are up there early. So there's not really a bad time to go.
Yeah. Right.
Different things depending on when you're there. And that's what I've learned over the years of going up there is depending on when I go up there, I'm just targeting different fish, but there's never a bad time to be up there. That's for sure.
No, that's it. Cool. Now describe a little bit. So we've got the fish and we'll come back to this in a little bit, but as far as the Togiak Lodge, maybe from your perspective, how would you describe that? The lodge, the area, just that whole experience up there.
Yeah. So if you were to pay to come up and be a client, you're going to fly into Anchorage. Then you're going to get on a smaller plane that they shuttle in. They hire this charter.
Oh, okay.
And then you fly from Anchorage into this small, I think there's about 800 people in this native village of Togiak. And you land on a gravel runway. You know, it's just everything
cool.
You ever thought of when you want to go up to Alaska. And then from there, the lodge, we pick the clients up at the airport. And then we make our way down to the beach, which is this gravelly beach. It's not what you would normally think of, but it's right on Bristol Bay. That part's incredible. And then we get in jet boats and then we run 6 miles up the river to get to the lodge.
Mm.
So you're about as remote as you're going to get in Alaska.
What are you seeing when you land, when you get on that area and you're getting in the jet boats? What's it look? Is it just like water everywhere? Are there other tundra? What's it look like?
Yeah, it's all tundra. There are no, because I was kind of, I had this vision of Alaska, you know, and it was in the mountains and the trees all around you. Well, the tundra is very different than that.
Yeah.
And this is all tundra. But the tundra is kind of unique and special on its own. You know, when you come flying down into that Togiak Valley, you can just see braids shooting everywhere off of the Togiak River and other small tribs. There's ponds. Oh, there's probably 3,000 small ponds you can see down in the tundra as you're flying into land.
Oh, right.
And yeah. Yeah. I keep telling my cousin, like, we need a helicopter.
Yeah. That's right. The helicopter.
Yeah. There's so much to fish, but you just can't get to it because you can't. You get a little bit of feeling of being, you know, the island syndrome, because you can't really, from the lodge, you can't just go out and go for a walk for 2 miles. Like you can't walk and get tundra.
And why is it? What's the tundra? Is it just like a sponge sort of thing?
Yeah. And behind the lodge, and we haven't even talked about this part. So behind the lodge, there's a pike pond. They're just full of pike. And my brother and I, the first year we were out there, we'd never caught a pike. And so we're like, we really want to do, and all the guides are like, you don't want to go out there. There's so many mosquitoes. And
oh, man.
It's nasty. But we are waterfowl hunters. We've hiked through miles of places that most people wouldn't want to go fishing. So we're like, we're going to do it. So we start heading out to the pike pond and I'm on that tundra and all of a sudden I notice the tundra is kind of moving. And then I keep walking and it feels like I'm on a waterbed.
No kidding. And you're sinking?
We're floating on top. Well, you're staying up on the tundra, but every step that you take, the tundra wants to rotate 90 degrees in one direction. It feels like we're walking on a waterbed.
Oh, wow. So is it dangerous at all?
Well, so once you get out there, I mean, who knows how deep that is underneath you? You went through that tundra. It's a little exhilarating, just to not know. But we went out there the first time, 5 or 6 years ago, and it was just my brother and I. And I look up to him so much. He's the one who taught me how to fish as a kid and took me hunting all the time. And so we're out there, just the two of us, and he's got a spinning rod with a frog on it. I got a mouse on my fly rod, and he casts out his first cast, and that frog comes hopping across that, and all of a sudden, just explosion from the pipe.
Nice.
As far as the topwater, and I live on a topwater river. I fish hopper dropper all year long.
Oh, right.
On the Yakima? I live on the Natchez River near the Yakima. It's a small tributary that goes into the Yakima. So I've seen topwater eats all the time, but those pike are just a different thing. Those little mini alligators are feisty. And we haven't really gotten into any that are giant. I mean, probably the biggest pike that I've caught up there is 24, 26 inches. They're not huge.
Yeah. But still, I mean, it's cool though.
And having that other option of, if you've never caught a pike,
you
can come to the lodge and I guarantee you can catch a pike.
Oh, really? So you can get this fight. You can get all 5 Pacific salmon. You can get and you can add pike to your list on the same trip.
Yeah. Yeah. So in my times up there, I've caught every species of salmon, dolly, rainbow, grayling, and pike.
And pike.
All on a fly rod. So that's a pretty good spread of species on a fly rod up there. That's, I don't know if you're going to find a better place where you can catch more species than that.
Picture this, you're casting your line into the pristine waters of the Togiak River, surrounded by untouched Alaskan wilderness. At Togiak River Lodge, the dream becomes a reality. Here, every cast brings a chance of a lifetime, battling salmon or reeling in that majestic rainbow trout. But it's not just the fish, it's the adventure. With Togiak's expert guides and exclusive access to over 30 miles of river, your fishing story is waiting to be written. And guess what? I'll be joining this summer too. Don't let this be the one that got away. Visit TogiakLodge.com right now. That's Togiak, TogiaK Lodge right now, and embark on your unforgettable journey. Remember, it's not just fishing, it's Togiak. What about the old bugs and bears conversation? That's always some people that don't know Alaska, they're worried like the bugs are going to eat them. What's your take?
Yeah, they should be worried.
Really, it can be pretty bad.
Those mosquitoes up there are just a different, my wife's never come up there with me. She's always stayed home. She doesn't really have much desire to get up into Alaska. And I was telling her about the mosquitoes and how big they were and how bad they were. And I had some pictures. I have a picture of me holding a grayling and it looks like there's crows flying all over around my head.
How do you deal with that? How do you prepare for that?
Mosquito netting over my head. And there's some place, like when you go out to the pike pond, you're going to want to put a mosquito net over your head. You're not going to bug juice up enough to take care of it. There's times that you have to wear a net. If you're on the river itself, there's enough breeze blowing that it kind of makes the mosquitoes less of a nuisance. But if you get out into the tundra, they're just, even at the lodge, there can be a lot of mosquitoes. I got home from up there one summer and I went to get my contacts out of my Ziploc baggie and there were about 4 or 5 dead mosquito carcasses in the bag. So I was like, Jamie, you got to see these. And I'm pulling back and they're crunching in my hand.
Oh.
A mosquito here at home lands on you and you just kind of wipe it and it disintegrates.
Yeah, these are giant.
Oh, there's times I slap them. I feel like they slap me back. Right. So the mosquitoes are and then when the mosquitoes kind of start dying down and the white sox show up, so you don't really get a break from the bugs.
Yeah, that's right.
And then the grizzly bears, like especially later in July, if you're up there, you're going to, every evening when you're back at the lodge, they're going to come rolling through. You're going to see the grizzly bears.
Oh, amazing. So you're actually going to see, you're going to have a good chance to see some grizzly bears.
Yeah, there's much excitement. And if you work up there, you kind of get annoyed by them because they get into stuff. They're kind of a nuisance, but the clients that are up there every night, they're out taking pictures and you're less likely to see moose, but I've seen moose right at the lodge.
Yeah.
Where we're running up the bank on the other side of the river. We've seen a wolverine. There's a lot of minks, otter. There's quite a few different funds. Just the golden eagles, bald eagles. I mean, there's lots of wildlife that you can take in. And I've told several friends they like to fish, but they're not really big into fishing, but they want to see the adventure. And I tell them it's worth the trip just for the adventure.
Yeah, it is.
Just to see all the wildlife and get to get to see what this world looked like before we had roads that took you everywhere. And
yeah,
you know, we sit at the lodge and you look it up at the mountains, there are no roads.
Well, that's what's cool about this. You hear guests, I've heard guests on the podcast talk about some other areas, like, I don't know, you name it, Russia, Eastern Canada. And they say how, like, you know, they kind of almost talk down on Alaska. Like, it's Alaska's kind of become this busy thing and there's people everywhere. Do you think there's truth to that? Or are you saying that it is pretty remote where you're at, here at Togiak?
Not on the Togiak. And you don't have to go real far. Even up on the Gishik, you know, you go up on the side trip and then you head up at about 5 miles. You get up in there and you are as secluded as I've ever felt on this planet. And not very often down in the lower 48 do you understand what absolute silence sounds like, because there's not much of a time you can be outside and not hear an airplane flying over or some kind of, when you get up there, it's absolute, you know. And then I'm doing my favorite activity, which is fishing on top of that. And it's a special, special place.
Sweet. Well, we talked a little bit about, you know, the salmon. I mean, it sounds like we talked chum, sockeye without going too deep, pinks. I'm guessing coho is really easy to strip them into your feet. Is that kind of the same game with coho?
Yeah. Yeah. If you're up there during the peak of coho, you can catch as many as you want in a day. You get to a point where you take a break just because your arm's so sore from catching fish. Coho is probably the most for a fly fisherman. Like, if you can get into a rotation, because the problem is that's the busiest season for the lodge too. Because people know it. They want to go up. Most people, when they go to Alaska, they want to, you know, get their arm ripped off, and coho season's the time to do that.
Well, that's what's great about, I think that's what's awesome about, you know, this, because there's all sorts of different levels, from the beginner who hasn't been up there, caught any salmon, coho could be the most amazing thing ever, or to the person maybe like me, where I've done, you know, a lot of everything else, but really the Chinook is one thing where I'm thinking, man, if I could swing up a Chinook, you know, that would be epic, even if it was just one.
Yeah. And, so even, I mean, probably the middle to end of July, I've been catching kings up there at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can swing flies on a two-handed fly rod, but you can also fish the beads on a single-handed rod.
Oh, and you can?
Oh, yeah.
What's your technique? What's your Chinook? What would be your technique on a Chinook? If you were going to be fishing for Chinook up there, how have you done in the past?
Well, I was determined that I was going to catch, because up there, the Chinook are a different breed than they are here at home. And the guides up there won't really give you credit for catching an adult Chinook unless it's 16 pounds.
Oh, really?
Anything before that's a super jack.
Oh, that's funny.
And I probably landed 5 or 6 of them in that, you know, 14, 15 Jeez. Pounds. And they just won't give it to, they're like, no, that's a super jack.
Oh, that's funny.
So I was determined I was going to catch one on my fly rod. And I started throwing, because what they use on conventional gear is a big soft bead. They'll fish a 32 mil soft bead under a bobber to catch the kings on a spinning rod. And so I started throwing a 32 millimeter soft bead on my fly rod. It was like a bouncy ball on the end of my fly rod.
What is 32 mils? Is that kind of like is that like a bobber size? How big is that? Like the size of a penny?
Yeah, it would be like real good size indicator. Probably it's about the size of a quarter.
Oh, wow. Yeah, huge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a huge, it looks like a big, like a bouncy ball as you get out of the quarter machines at the pizza place.
Right.
Like it looks like a bouncy ball that I put on. So you put it on your fly line, and those fish are so aggressive that I was fishing it without an indicator. And I put a sink tip on, and I would just cast out, let it free float down through, and all of a sudden the line would just get heavy, and that's the fish. And then you set the hook, and I was catching kings like that on a single-handed fly rod.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah. Out of a boat on an 8-weight.
Oh, yeah. Now, why out of a boat? Why not off the bank? Could you do it off the bank too?
Yeah. The river just doesn't have, it has some good gravel bars, but you're going to want to fish a spay rod. You're going to want to swing a fly through in those situations. It's harder to get to use the bead. Usually, if you're using the bead, you're hitting like down through the deeper pockets. And sometimes it's harder to get to those unless you're in a boat. So I did a lot of fishing out of a boat in those situations. And I'm new to the two. I just bought a trout spay last summer. So I've been fishing on my local river, the trout spay. But eventually, I'd like to get into a little bit of spay fishing and get up there and try to get a king on a spay rod. And I know that my cousins, you know, that's where they're kind of taking the lodges in that direction. When I first started going up there, I was one of the few fly fishermen. Everything was gear. It was all about filling your box with salmon and taking home 50 pounds.
Sure. Rack them and stack them. Yep.
Yeah. And Jordan and Zach, they're a little more conscious to that that's not something that's sustainable. And we need to be focusing on more catch and release. You know, they offer, you know, if anybody catches a big king and they let it go, but this was back before it was when you could still keep them, before they were required to let them go, they were encouraging their clients to do, And if you got a picture of it, they would send them an oil blown up picture of that fish.
Oh, that's awesome.
As encouragement to let these fish go. So they've been moving the lodge this direction. But I think that, you know, the future is more of the fly fishing, the catch and release, which I'm all for. That's me here at home too. And I have kept some of the sockeye up there. If I'm going to bring home salmon to eat, I'm not bringing home king. I'm not bringing home coho. I'm bringing home sockeye.
Right.
It's the best eating fish anyways.
Yeah, it's the best.
And the sockeye runs up there aren't hurting. They're still thriving. So if people want to bring home fish, bring home sockeye. Don't try to, because you can keep some of the jacks up there. But I'm just saying, let's save those coho. Let's let them keep doing their thing. And
exactly.
Yeah.
That's sweet. So that's it. So, there are areas, I'm guessing, you can go up there with the spay rod, find a place like a bar if you wanted to kind of swing and step down through a run. I mean, we just had George Cook on a while back, and he was talking about the Chinook fishing and finding the pillow water. He was saying how you have these really deep buckets where the Chinook are hanging, but there's the pillow water, which is really what you want. Not the super deep stuff, but right on that edge where they're just kind of chilling. And is there some of that water you could find, maybe even get out on a bar?
100%. And actually, as you head up from the lodge, there's about 10 mile of river that they can fish. You can't go into the wilderness area up there with a guide. And in that system, you get up a little ways further and everything just shoots into these braids. They call it the braids. There's braids that go everywhere. And within those braids, if I was going to go up there and target two-handed spay rod, I would be in the braids. It looks the most like fishing streamers at home.
Yeah.
The main channel of the Togiak, it's a pretty significant river.
Oh, it's big.
And it's a big, if you've seen the Yakima River,
yep,
it's probably got more water coming down it from the Yakima River. It's a significant size river. This is not, you're not going to wade and fish the Togiak. It's a big river, but it's a lot of sandbars that you can get out on. And especially for coho, I fished for coho quite a bit off of the sandbar, and that was a good time.
Oh, nice. Nice, right on. This is great. Okay, so anything else we want to throw out here about the fishing? I mean, we didn't go deep into the techniques and stuff, but anything just high level you want to shed light on about the experience or the fishing or anything people should be thinking about if they've been thinking about doing this in the past?
Yeah, and we didn't talk a lot. The lodge is great.
Yeah.
It's not a five-star lodge, but you're also in the middle of the tundra. But you're on the tundra in a solid structure, and the lodge is completely built on stilts because it's on the tundra. There's no foundations. So the fact that that's up there, and they've done a really good job the last couple of years of fixing things up. And compared to the first summer I went up there to now, the lodge it's just way superior. And it's with what they've done, the structurally it's more superior. The aesthetics of it's the lodge itself where you eat is a welcoming environment where you can hang out. The food up there, they bring in some top notch chefs to be
cooking. Oh, they do.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And you're eating tri-tip.
Oh, nice.
It's quite the experience. Just the food alone is worth the trip. Every morning there's about five or six different choices of breakfast.
Uh-huh.
You can get your eggs and hash browns. You can get your French toast. You definitely don't leave you wanting for much when you're up there as far as food goes. They usually end up doing a shore lunch. That can be a lot of fun where, 3 or 4 miles up the river, they'll find a bar somewhere and the cook will come up and make a fire pit and cook some salmon, and they have salads and set them all up on tables right there on the bank. And you're right on that. You're watching the float planes fly over you and you're sitting there having lunch, and it's the incredible Alaskan experience.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it. This is cool.
And
yeah.
And the fishing.
And the fishing's good.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's just there are times that especially with the sockeye running, and you can sit in the boat, look down in the water, and you can't see the bottom of the river. There's so many sockeye running up that river.
Oh, wow.
It's just unbelievable. Yeah. And, it's one of the last places you can go and target, and that's just, it's becoming more and more rare. And the fact that they still got it and you can still do it is pretty amazing.
Yeah. No, it is. It is. And the fact that you have pretty much all the species. The cool thing about the lodge is, we talked about this on the last one. I talked to Jordan, there's even the DIY, there are some people that could do that. But again, it's nice probably to get out of the bugs and have the cabin, right? When you can get out of it, get a nice shower and all that stuff.
Oh, the shower is probably the best part. And be prepared when, three summers ago, I worked up there for King City. I was up there for 52 days and it rained for 47 of 52 days.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember we were up there, too, in another part of Alaska, and it was just, this was 2 years ago or 3 years ago?
two or three summers ago.
Yeah, I was up. We came in September, I think, or it was late. It was after it rained and stuff. It was just starting to settle down. But yeah, they said it rained straight.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so just because you're going up there in July, don't be thinking you're going to get summer weather. It could be raining 52 degrees with 30 mile an hour winds the whole time you're there. And if you want to go fishing, you better be prepared. So the other thing would be clothing.
Yeah, what do you recommend
about
that?
Going up there? You know, they have some waders there that are the lodge that you can use, but I would suggest bring a good pair of waders. That's going to be important. Rain jackets are really important, and the type of rain jacket is really important. You can't just have, you know, a Columbia lightweight rain jacket and think that's going to be enough. I put on full rubber gear when I'm floating the river.
Oh, you go with the rubber.
Oh, yeah. It needs to be. So I'll wear my waders with my rubber jacket if I really need to stay dry. I'm an electric vest guy. I've discovered all these new electric clothing that they've had come out.
And electric? Oh, you mean like to keep you warm?
Oh, yeah. So I'll throw an electric vest underneath of my rain gear. And then that way, if I start, because when you're running that river, you know, and the rain's coming down sideways, even with rain gear on, you're going to get wet and you're going to get cold. So I have my electric, so I just kick it on high. And if I start getting cold, man, it kicks me back up real quick.
No kidding.
Because that's part of the enjoyment up there, is being able to be out in that weather and not be miserable.
Yeah.
And so being prepared with your clothing is something to think about. And I would bring more than one rain jacket, because a lot of times one's completely soaking wet still, and you got to go back out after lunch. So to have a jacket you can hang up and then grab another one to head back out after lunch, I would bring multiple rain jackets with you for sure.
Yeah. I always feel like having that dry bag, a little, you know, bag that you take with you where you can put an extra change of clothes right in there, and a jacket in case something happens.
Yep. And I usually take a dry bag up there with me to throw in the boat so that I can have stuff in the boat. All the boats that are up there are open boats with their tillers. So you're not going to get much protection from the weather when you're out fishing. So just be prepared for that.
Yep, perfect. This is good. I think this has given us a nice little summary, definitely a nice perspective on it. I wanted to hear a little bit, you mentioned, you know, about your home water and kind of the stuff you're doing up there, you know, with Reds. What is that? When are you going to be starting that? Is that something where you're going to, this summer, this spring, are you going to be doing that soon?
Yeah, so this summer is I live on the Natchez River, which is a small tributary that goes into the Yakima. Lesser known river, and it's been great because I've had the whole river to myself, but people have started to discover my little sanctuary. And so this last summer, I've known Joe at Reds and his guides for the last couple of years, and last summer they started guiding on this river, and I was like, well, if they're gonna do it, I might as well jump in. So
right.
I'll be guiding here on the Natchez River. I have a 9.5 foot NRS slipstream raft with the fishing frame, and just one single fisherman with me in my raft. And we do about, you know, 6 to 10 mile float. And when things are on fire, lots of top water, lots of hopper dropper, lots of native cutthroat, wild rainbows. And the whitefish on this river are probably the best kept secret. A lot of people talk bad about whitefish. I really enjoy fishing for whitefish. Matter of fact, when we get done, I'm going to head over to the river as soon as we hang up on this call, and whitefish is what's open right now. So I'll go over and try to see if I can pick me up a couple of whitefish. And I'm a school teacher, so this is just a side job for me. And I'll probably take 15 to 20 people fishing this summer down the river. And eventually when I'm done teaching, I'll probably end up the lodge with my cousins and guide up there for them a little bit.
That's cool.
The hard thing up there is you have to be a guide up there. You have to have a six pack.
Oh, what's a six pack?
So it's your captain's license.
Oh, you need a captain's license.
You have to have your captain's license. And I just haven't dedicated the time and the money to go get my captain's license. So it'll have to happen at some point if I want to guide up there. And I know that, but yeah, here at home, I don't have to have the six pack to guide here at home in my raft. So no. It'll be a lot easier.
No, that's right. What's your relationship to Jordan and Justin? What's the family connection?
So Jordan and Zach are my cousins.
And they're what? It's your dad's brother, or how's the connection?
Their dad is my mom's brother. And Jordan and Zach are quite a bit younger than I am. I'm 50. You know, they're in their mid to late 20s.
Yeah.
They're two amazing young men that have done this at a very young age. But their dad, when I was a kid, so my oldest brother and their dad were the people who taught me how to fish. So this started out as me going up there with my uncle before they even owned it. And then now that they own it, so a lot of the time that we're up there, I'm out fishing with my uncle, you know, spending time with my family. My aunt is part of the lodge. She helps run the kitchen and a lot of the housekeeping stuff. And so it's a whole family affair. Here's my aunt and my uncle up there, my two cousins, and I have other cousins that have been up there with me. My brothers have come up there with me. My nephews have been up there with me.
Uh-huh.
So the whole family is just, it's been a fun place for the family to be able to go and enjoy the outdoors in a way that the Northwest doesn't really provide anymore. You know, it's hard to get away from people in the Northwest anymore. There's so many people everywhere. And to be able to go up there and get away is really special. Get that time with our family. Last year, Jordan and I went up. I think it was the last day I was up there. And so we went and he took his drone, and he's done quite a bit of filming. So we took the drone and did some tutorials on how I'm fly fishing up there. And we just had a blast, just the two of us out for, you know, 4 or 5 hours of just fishing the two of us. And yeah, some of the best memories I've had with family are up at that lodge. And and not just my family, but watching other families come up there and their time together and, you know, out on the boat, and here's a dad and the three kids out fishing together throughout the whole day, and come back in for lunch and they're telling stories around the tables or eating, and just watching them build those connections is a special thing.
That's perfect. Yeah, I think that's a nice place to kind of take it away, because the family thing is great. I think that's really cool that the lodge is all kind of built around that. And so maybe you can just give us out of the conversation today, you know, maybe a few, maybe three takeaways, and maybe takeaways or tips on, again, somebody's thinking now, like, okay, they've heard a little more about this. I'm looking at a picture of Togiak right now with a bear eating with the sunset, you know, and so you know, you're gonna have plenty of that. But what would be your, on the conversation today, what would you tell that person to be like, okay, here's a few takeaways to be thinking about, maybe that we covered today, or maybe just to remind them what they should be thinking about heading up?
But just, I would say for anybody, remember that fishing's fishing.
Yeah.
And even when you're in Alaska, there are times I'm struggling to catch fish.
Right.
Don't let that be your expectation. Don't let that ruin the trip for you if you have an afternoon where the fishing's a little slow, because we all know that pressure affects fish and how much they're eating. And there's other things that are in play more. There's times you can see the fish, but they're not biting. You're not going to catch fish. And it's still fishing. And so take it as this is an adventure you're going on. And there's going to be some fishing in there. And there might be a day you go and you catch more. 2 years ago, I went up there and we took Marcus from Fish Alaska Magazine. My uncle and I took him and Brian, his cameraman. And we fished for 4 or 5 days. And I probably, in those 4 or 5 days, I probably landed over 1,000 fish.
Huh.
I gave myself tendonitis when I got home. So there's that time that I was up there. But then there have been other times that we go out for a day and it's struggle bus. You're working hard to catch the fish. And that would be my number one.
Yeah, expectations. Yep.
Expectations of it's still fishing. You're still going to have hard days, but then there are going to be some really good days. Number two would be expect some bad weather, like we just talked about with the clothing. You know, that's part of the Alaskan experience. Just getting into the lodge, you know, there's chances of delays. If there's too much fog and the planes can't land, you may not get in for a day, or you might not get out for a day. Like, that's part of the experience. And don't let that, you know, because it's hard to travel up there, that's part of why you're going. Don't let that be a deterrent or make your trip seem less fun because you had some travel problems or weather problems. That's just part of the experience. And then number three, I mean, I've seen people come up there by themselves to get the experience, but it's not nearly as fun as when I see a group of people up there.
A group. Yeah. So try to put a group together.
Try to have a group of people, you know, have three or four of you to share a room. You get that camaraderie, you know, on the boat, giving each other a hard time when one person's catching fish and somebody else isn't. That's part of the experience too, is getting those relationships that are built through the process.
Yeah, that's it. Perfect. No, those are awesome. I think that's a great way to leave it. I'm going to ask you one more here. You mentioned you're a music teacher. What is your, you know, you play the trombone, is that correct?
I play the trumpet. It's my main instrument.
Oh, the trumpet. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. I'm not good with music, but yeah. What's your type? If we were to go on Spotify and find some music, a band or type of music, what would you be listening to if you're on a road trip heading out fishing?
I listen to country.
You do?
I'm going to have my country music.
What would be a country? What's a band or person or somebody out there we could put in the show and check it out on Spotify?
I don't really have a favorite or a least favorite there.
Like old school? Would it be like old school country or newer stuff?
Yeah. Give me some Oak Ridge Boys.
Oak Ridge Boys. There you go.
Yeah. I was a choral teacher. I taught choir for a while too. And I think that they just, but for me, the country music is about the mood. You know, when I'm going on a road trip somewhere, I need music. I don't want to be thinking about it. I just need mood music to put me in a good mood. And that's going to be any anything. I have Apple Music, and I put it on any of their country channels and just let it go.
It's all good. Perfect. Love it. We'll put some Oak Ridge Boys in the show notes as well, and we'll throw it in hopefully on Instagram.
Perfect.
But cool, Jeremy. Well, I think we'll leave it there. We'll send everybody out to, I guess it's JF2 Fly Fishing on Instagram, and then also TogiakLodge.com if people want to dig in deeper. But yeah, this has been awesome today. I appreciate the feedback, the passion, really. I mean, I can hear it in your voice, how much you love it. So yeah, appreciate your time today.
Yeah. Appreciate you. If you ever have any questions, get a hold of me. I'm more than happy to let you know.
There we go. Jeremy knocking this one out. You can send me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com, if you have any feedback for this podcast. If you have any show ideas or topics, please check in with me anytime. Love to hear back from you. You can check in right now at wetflyswing.com/school and see what we have going with our trips. And you can enter right now to get more information at wetflyswing.com/school. Okay, I'm glad you were able to stop in today. I hope you have a great evening, a great morning, or a great afternoon, wherever you are in the world. And I look forward to catching up with you on that next episode.